content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine's issue dated July 6, 2026. This is the issue that has two covers. They're both for Time. They both have red borders, white narrow inner borders. The first one says, in captions, American Icons, curated by Ralph Lauren. It shows a fabric, perhaps knitted, flag motif on top of denim. That's the cover photo, and Ralph Lauren has a signature there. 1776 Star, 2026, USA Forever, American Icons. The stars and stripes are red and white, and 13. Yep. And stars, or those are the stripes, the stars are on the field of blue in the upper left corner, but there are only 5, 10, 13 of them. Now, the second front cover says Our America, and it says Time. Well, the other one did too, but it's almost obscured by the American Icons caption. Time, in large white block capital lettering, is prominent on the second cover. It says Our America, which is in white along with Time, upon a gradiated blue background. And in the front of the back, well, on the cover, is the face and the shoulders of the Statue of Liberty. However, it is revised. The face is revised to a more modern look than the actual statue's face. And this statue on the cover is wearing kind of a drapery over its shoulders with red, white, and blue motif and stars and smaller illustrations or photographs. There's something that says, it's a photo of Abraham Lincoln. It says, We the People, Votes for Women, Route 66, various other little iconographic decorations. All right, to the brief business, first of all, climate. Navigating the Corporate Sustainability Shift by Charlotte Hu, H-U. This is one page, and it includes a list that I will read. In recent years, as corporate sustainability goal calculations changed, companies have shifted their focus to operational efficiency and cost savings. Meanwhile, a looming energy crisis, the result of the war in Iran, threatens to drive up prices for all kinds of goods. Despite all this, Maria Mendelucci, CEO of the We Mean Business Coalition, believes many companies are still carrying out their long-term commitments because they realize climate change and biodiversity loss pose serious threats to business. Pragmatism is coming to the sustainability agenda, both on the corporate standard setters and the policy makers, she says. To assess which corporations prioritize sustainability in their business practices, Time and data firm Statista partnered on the third annual edition of the world's most sustainable companies to rank 750 of the world's largest and most influential companies based on their transparency, accountability, and impact on the environment. Clear leaders emerge, including among firms whose main business is selling clean energy technologies. Decarbonization solutions provider Schneider Electric has been the top-ranked company since 2024. Luxury clothing brand Moncler has also maintained high ranks by recycling materials. The brand reported using more than 55% of yarns and fabrics made from recycled, organic, regenerative, or certified alternatives in 2025. Sherry Madera, CEO of the Carbon Disclosure Project, CDP, notes an increased demand for water use disclosure data on its platform because it impacts industries from food to AI. And with the European Union's Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, a tariff on carbon-intensive goods that came into effect at the start of 2026, more global companies are interested in disclosure data because they want to understand how the tax will affect their economics. Additionally, redesigns of key international standards are setting the bar for credible corporate climate action going forward. Climate-positive policies, like the 2025 Refuel EU Aviation Initiative, requiring at least 2% of the fuel supplied at EU airports be sustainable aviation fuel, has encouraged airport operators like AENA to develop incentives to promote its uptake. These companies are evidence that such changes are continuing to make a difference. Okay, here's the list. Now, there are 20 of these top 20 world's most sustainable companies. This was compiled by Time. It gives a rank, which I will read from 1 through 20. It gives the name of the company, the headquarters, the industry, and the score. And I'm not sure, I don't think I'll read the score because it doesn't tell me what the parameters of the scoring are. 1, Schneider Electric, France. Engineering, manufacturing, medical technology. NRI, Japan, professional services. 2, I should mention the number. 3, Moncler, Italy, apparel, footwear, sporting goods. Nokia, Finland, technology, media services. 5, NASDAQ, U.S., banking and financial services. KPN, Netherlands, telecommunications services. 7, NEC, Japan, technology, media services. 8, Castellum, Sweden, real estate. Here's a note. Castellum is 8. The company develops Nordic properties certified as sustainable. 9, AENA, A-E-N-A, Spain, resource generation and infrastructure sector. EDP Group, Portugal, utilities. This note says the Portuguese utility giant manages renewable energy projects worldwide. 11, Aclona, Spain, conglomerate. 12, Cellnex, Spain, telecommunications services. 13, ASM, Netherlands, IT, electronics, hardware, equipment. 14, Pandora, Denmark, apparel, footwear, sporting goods. 15, Pearson, UK, technology, media, services. 16, Lojas Renner, Brazil, retail, wholesale, consumer goods. There's a note here that says Renner is the largest fashion retailer in Brazil and collects clothes and shoes to be recycled. 17, GEA Group, Germany, engineering, manufacturing, medical technology. 18, Adobe, U.S., technology, media, services. 19 Trane, T-R-A-N-E, Technologies, Ireland, Engineering, Manufacturing, Medical Technology. 20 Tech Mahindra, India, Technology, Media, Services. Turning the page now to Health by Angela Haupt. 5 things orthopedic surgeons do to stay strong as they age. Every day, Dr. David Shaw, S-H-A-U, holds a plank position on his living room floor, and his toddler sits on his back, giggling. This is core training, orthopedic surgeon style, and it's one of the milder things that Shaw, who specializes in hip and knee replacements, does to keep his own body in working order. Ask an orthopedic surgeon, doctors who specialize in the musculoskeletal system, including bones, joints, ligaments, and muscles, what they do to stay healthy, and the answers get strange fast. They do toe yoga at their desks. They hop around like pogo sticks at the bus stop. They brush their teeth in a lunge, stretching the Achilles tendon they know is often the first to go. They lower their bodies from a standing position to a cross-legged seat on the floor, then try to stand back up without using their hands or losing their balance. People who can do this, it has been shown, have 1/5 the risk of dying in a given time frame as people who cannot. These are not quirks. They are the byproduct of a job spent watching what happens when people stop maintaining their bodies. The surgeons who rebuild knees, replace hips, and fuse spines for a living often develop a set of personal habits that do not look much like the wellness advice the rest of us hear. Some are surprisingly tiny, some are weird, and all of them are doable. Here is what orthopedic surgeons do to stay strong, mobile, and upright as they age. 1. They prioritize legs over almost everything else. The single biggest driver of losing your independence as you age, it is not your heart or even your memory, says Dr. Corey Callendine, an orthopedic surgeon in Brentwood, Tennessee. It's your legs. Once you cannot stand from a chair without using your hands, or catch yourself when you stumble, the cascade starts. That is why for Callendine, every Sunday is leg day at the gym, where he uses weight machines to work one leg at a time. It lets him keep the weights heavy while protecting his spine. I train legs like my life depends on it, says Callendine, and statistically, it does. 2. They train at their desks. Dr. Vonda Wright, an orthopedic surgeon in Orlando, trains her balance and foot speed daily to help protect against falls, which become riskier with age. It takes just a few seconds. When sitting at her desk, she does quick sessions where she taps her toes as fast as she can. At bus stops, she hops in place doing pogos. You might get some looks, she says, but your health is worth it. 3. They check the soles of their shoes regularly. Flip your shoes over and look at the tread. If you cannot see the pattern anymore, it is time to replace them, says Dr. Heather Menzer, an orthopedic surgeon at Phoenix Children's Hospital. Worn shoes are a sneaky culprit behind foot pain and beyond. Knee, hip, and back pain can all trace back to shoes that have lost their support, she says. 4. They strengthen their core with body weight exercises. Shaw is unequivocal about the importance of core strength. Taking care of your core can really offset a lot of different pains throughout your body, he says. Most lower back issues stem from weak abdominal and pelvic muscles. That's why his daily routine centers on holding a plank for as long as he can with his daughter sitting on his back. Another option is sitting at a 90-degree angle with your back against a wall for as long as you can hold it. Both moves are body weight exercises that require no equipment and minimal space. 5. They take rest as seriously as training. Recovery is not the absence of training, it is part of it, Menzer says. Tissue repair happens when you rest, not when you train. The actual rebuilding that exercise initiates happens during sleep and downtime, which means an under-recovered body never gets the benefit of the work it is putting in. The View, History, The Words That Made America, by Isaac Jacobson. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Isaacson, who wrote this, is author of The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. This essay is excerpted from Declare, A Civic Gospel, from Arion Press, and Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. At the Second Continental Congress of the American Colonies, meeting in Philadelphia, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia proposed a motion, June 7, 1776, that proclaimed, "These United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states." As the Congress prepared to vote on that question, it appointed a committee to draft a declaration explaining the decision. It included Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston. Because John Adams, perhaps the most zealous member of the committee, thought a Virginian author was essential, Jefferson, at 33, got the not entirely welcome honor of drafting the document, which he did in a rented second-floor room on Market Street, just a block from Franklin's home and the State House that would later be known as Independence Hall. He used a portable mahogany writing desk that he designed and brought with him from Virginia, assisted by his enslaved valet, Robert Hemings. Jefferson's writing style was graced with rolling cadences and mellifluous phrases powerful beneath their polish. He echoed both the language and the grand theories of English and Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, most notably the concept of natural rights propounded by John Locke, whose second treatise on government he had read at least 3 times. He also borrowed freely from the Declaration of Rights in the new Virginia Constitution that had just been drafted a few weeks earlier by his fellow planter, George Mason. When he finished his first draft, Jefferson sent it to Franklin on the morning of Friday, June 21. "Will Dr. Franklin be so good as to peruse it?" he wrote in his cover note, "and suggest such alterations as his more enlarged view of the subject will dictate." For the next 10 days, the committee made edits and tweaks. Most notable was the crafting of the soaring second sentence. Other nations have been born out of conquests and rebellions, usually based on tribal or religious identities, but the United States was born out of an ideal, which the final version proclaimed in the memorable words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It may be the greatest sentence ever crafted, and each word has special meaning and resonance. The first word of the sentence is also the first word in our Constitution, drafted 11 years later, which begins, "We, the people." The use of the word "we" signifies our governance is not based on the divine right of kings or the power imposed by emperors and conquerors. It is based on a compact, a social contract that we, the people, have entered into. Jefferson was invoking this collective will, not just the will of the 60 men gathered in Philadelphia to represent the people, when he began the sentence with the word "we." He went on to write, "We hold these truths to be sacred." Franklin crossed out "sacred," using the heavy backslash marks he had often employed as a printer, and wrote in self-evident. Their declaration, he believed, was intended to herald a new type of nation, one in which our rights are based on reason, not the dictates or dogma of religion. The phrase self-evident has a very specific meaning in analytic philosophy. More than just a fancy way to say obvious, the concept was developed by Franklin's close friend, the Scottish philosopher David Hume. Hume developed a theory, later known as Hume's fork, that there are two types of truths. Synthetic truths are statements whose veracity is contingent on empirical evidence and observations. Analytic truths are so by reason and definition. For example, all bachelors are unmarried. To confirm a synthetic truth, you have to observe real-world facts, but that's not the case with analytic truths. To know that all bachelors are unmarried, you do not have to go around surveying bachelors to see if any has a wife. Propositions of this kind are discoverable by the mere operation of thought, Hume wrote. Their truth is self-evident. The statement that men are created equal did not arise from observing different people and determining whether they were indeed equal. It instead derived from the fact they are all autonomous individuals who were created equally free and independent, as explained in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, written a month before the Declaration of Independence. But let's be honest. Labeling their assertions of these truths as self-evident was not entirely correct. They were, in fact, quite controversial, even revolutionary. Jefferson went on to use the phrase "all men." That seems on the surface to be very inclusive, and so it was in theory, but in practice it was, in fact, very restrictive. And its eventual expansion in fits and starts is a key element in the narrative of America. The words "man" and "men" have often been used, historically and to some extent today, to refer to humankind in general. Is this what Jefferson and the committee meant when they used the phrase "all men"? Yes, in a state of nature, but not in the social and political world that existed. Even if the rhetorical flourish of "all men" conveyed a broad scope, they consciously and intentionally did not mean, in most instances, to include women, slaves, Native Americans, and in some cases even non-property owners. The lengthy passage in Jefferson's draft of the Declaration denouncing the slave trade was edited out by the delegates before it was approved. Of the 56 signers, 41 owned slaves. When independence was declared, all 13 of the rebellious colonies permitted slavery. But the moral arc of American history during the subsequent 250 years mirrors the personal narrative of Franklin's life. Abraham Lincoln opened his Gettysburg Address in 1863 by referring directly to the second sentence of the Declaration. 80 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. At a cost of close to 700,000 lives, including 7,058 buried in the cemetery he dedicated, that day in Gettysburg, the Civil War brought an end to slavery. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, Martin Luther King Jr. said a century later, echoing an 1853 sermon by the abolitionist minister Theodore Parker. But it's important to remember the arc did not bend itself. It was and remains a constant American struggle to make the phrase, "all men are created equal," truly inclusive. The sentence culminates with the resounding famous phrase, "life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." In John Locke's original development of his contract theory, he identifies three fundamental rights: life, liberty, and property. When men enter into a social contract to empower a government, he writes, it is done with an intention in every one the better to preserve himself, his liberty, and property. Property is a cornerstone of Locke's theory of justice. By owning the fruits of their labor, people preserve their liberty and individual rights. Jefferson's formulation, the pursuit of happiness, is just a more aspirational, expansive, and breathing way to say all of that. It is your right and your opportunity to seek fulfillment, meaning, and well-being however you personally see fit. In other words, it defines what became known as the American Dream. At the official signing of the parchment copy of the Declaration, John Hancock, president of the Continental Congress, wrote his name with his famous flourish. "There must be no pulling different ways," he insisted. "We must all hang together." Franklin replied, alluding to what would happen to them if their revolution failed, "Yes, we must indeed all hang together, or most assuredly we shall all hang separately." As Franklin pointed out, our life or death challenge as a nation, whether it be in 1776 or 2026, is this: when there are so many forces dedicated to dividing us, how can we best hang together? One way is by reflecting on our fundamental principles, the ones proclaimed in the Declaration's great sentence. These truths became the creed that bound a diverse group of pilgrims and immigrants into one nation. For a people with many different beliefs and backgrounds, it defined our common ground and aspirations. That is what our founders were fighting for 250 years ago, and that is what we must continue to fight for today. Again, that was by Walter Isaacson. Turning the page now to the View essay, still within the history category. America, Success or Failure? Both, by Greg Jackson. Here we are, celebrating 250 years of American independence, and let's be honest, it's a bit awkward. Between episodes of political violence, polling data showing that trust in media is at its lowest in at least half a century, distrust in electoral institutions once held sacrosanct, it feels as if we are watching Uncle Sam and Lady Liberty reach the golden anniversary right as their relationship hits full meltdown. Some people cope with a situation like that by pretending everything's fine, ready to move forward with booking the swank venue for the big bash. Others roll their eyes at the thought of celebrating a marriage so clearly on the rocks. Who is right? It is both. We can recognize the problems and still raise a glass, and our history shows us why. After all, you did not think that we 21st century Americans are unique in facing the difficulty of living up to our own ideals, that we are facing unprecedented challenges to democracy, if only. Across 250 years, this ongoing experiment in self-governance has progressed far more than its backslid, but backslid it has. Indeed, we have gone through nightmares getting here, including abuses of the free press, deplorable political violence, the loss of trust in institutions, even the electoral process. And yet, recognizing the dual nature of the nation's past does not diminish the significance of its endurance. In fact, acknowledging the worst of that history shows what we can overcome. For God's sake, cut him to pieces in the face of the public. So wrote Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, effectively ordering a political hit imprint on Alexander Hamilton, an order that the shorter Virginian, Little Jimmy, executed to a T. This beloved Union did not even get through George Washington's first term before its first national newspapers, the Gazette of the United States and the National Gazette, became little more than partisan rags backing the nation's immediately formed parties. Then there was the scene of horror and murder in the words of the Maryland House of Delegates Investigating Committee that took place on the summer night of 1812, during which Jeffersonian Republicans in Baltimore pummeled, clubbed, stabbed, sliced, stoned, and dripped hot wax on the held-open eyeballs of Federalists. Maybe, hear me out, it is fair to say our forebears were not better at democracy than we are. As for elections, it seems we practically have a standing tradition every 4 years of declaring that this is the worst election ever. Are our recent elections really worse than 1828's, when John Quincy Adams was reported to have procured American girls for the Russian Tsar? Newspapers called JQA, the President of the United States, the pimp of the coalition. Meanwhile, his political foe and the election's victor, Andrew Jackson, arguably lost his wife to libel. It was shortly after reading twisted takes on her romantic past that she suffered a fatal heart attack. And when it comes to disputed presidential elections, the election of 1876 is my go-to example of awful. Four states submitted multiple sets of electoral votes. And that is to say nothing of the Democrats' violence and murder of black voters in the South. Ballot stuffing, as evidenced by South Carolina's mathematically impossible 101% voter turnout, attempted bribes, cries of civil war, corrupt election boards. The Democratic Party's lawyer, Jeremiah Black, was utterly convinced the Republic would never recover when the White House went to Republican Rutherford Hayes. According to Jeremiah, we can never expect such a thing as an honest election again. But here's the reality. Most Americans today don't even know what happened in that election. Not even the well-educated, in-the-know voters. That's how much of a blip on the radar what once seemed a terrifying nosedive off democracy's cliff is today. We could read these past shortcomings as failure, as nothing but American hypocrisy. But I see triumph over the worst of human nature. I see the country choosing union again and again. As we repair the relationship, renew our commitment to the best ideals, and refuse to let the better angels of our nature die. I'm not saying Uncle Sam and Lady Liberty don't have their problems, but there is a love, a connection, a devotion to something greater that so far has won out. Of course, that winning comes down to the real people in this relationship, and that is not our personifications of Uncle Sam or Lady Liberty. It is we, the people. Will we choose again? For me, that's a yes. I hope it is for you, too. So happy semi-quincentennial America. Here's to 250 sometimes embattled but also beautiful years. May we choose 250 more to come. Greg Jackson wrote that, and he's a podcaster, America 250 professor at Utah Valley University, and author of the new book, Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. Under the Nation heading, Bringing U.S. Justice Up to Date by Anna Zamora, who is founder and CEO of the Just Trust. Not long after the Declaration of Independence was signed in Philadelphia, Quaker reformers, alongside Benjamin Franklin, made a bold decision to overhaul the prevailing system of punishment. They shifted from beatings and executions in the town square toward something they described as moderate, just, and private, the penitentiary. At the time, it was radical and more humane. They believed our young country could do better. This early reform shows us American justice was meant to be resolute, principled, and restrained. And our founders always imagined our system would evolve, that a more perfect union required constant improvement. A quarter millennium later, we've forgotten their mandate. We have a chance to find that spirit again as we shape the next 250 years of justice. Let me be clear, any honest conversation about crime and justice requires us to hold two truths at once. People sometimes make terrible choices, and those choices should have consequences. That was true at our founding, and it is true now, but here in 2026, we know human behavior is more complicated than a simple good guy, bad guy narrative, and we need to be more sophisticated in our responses. We know poverty, trauma, violence, systemic bias, while not excuses for behavior, shape what options people have in the first place. Ignoring this reality leads to bad policy, polarization, and band-aid solutions. We cannot punish our way out of systemic failures, and we cannot excuse away personal responsibility. The next era of American justice must balance these truths carefully and humanely. Over the past 250 years, we have learned a lot about what improves safety, supports victims, and helps communities thrive, and we have clearer evidence than ever about where to go from here. Last year, 14 national organizations from the left and right, which agree on almost nothing else, agreed on four principles to guide the next era of justice: safety, accountability, fairness, dignity. Those principles are not abstract. They are already being built into real systems. In Dayton, Ohio, a blind man with mental illness was hours from being evicted from his apartment of 35 years. When he became agitated and the situation escalated, his landlord called a civilian crisis response unit for help instead of the police. The situation de-escalated. The man stayed out of jail, and he got connected to new housing. That is dignity in action. In Seminole, Oklahoma, a survivor of extreme physical and sexual violence sentenced to life in prison for her role in the murder of her abuser went home. She is the first person released under a new state law, letting courts revisit cases where abuse played a role and where time had already been served. That is fairness in action. In Newark, New Jersey, the homicide rate dropped to a 60-year low, driven by community-based public safety partnerships with police that did not exist a decade ago. That is safety in action. In Arkansas, lawmakers worked across the aisle on a bold bill that categorizes kids recruited into gangs and coerced into committing crimes as victims. It unlocked a suite of resources to help support children who suffered intense trauma, pairing age-appropriate consequences with substantial support to grow, learn, and contribute to their communities. That is accountability in action. These are the building blocks for a better justice system. These are the seeds we need for America's next 250 years. The question on this 250th birthday is whether we will water those seeds, whether we will build on what's working, and have the courage to let go of what is not. Turning the page to the View essay, The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. America was born into geopolitics. The Republic's first decades were shaped by the rivalry between the British and French empires. And George Washington used his farewell address to warn his countrymen against permanent foreign entanglements. For much of the next century and a half, they listened. Then came the world wars, and after them a choice without precedent, not just to engage with the world, but to organize it. Every American president from Harry Truman onward committed the country to leading a volatile world, building alliances, underwriting institutions, defending a rule of law that Washington mostly chose to live within. The commitment was bipartisan, and for 80 years it held. It no longer does. A politics of grievance has taken hold inside the U.S., reflecting a growing conviction that the old bargains no longer pay off for ordinary Americans. Much of the country has come to see its commitments to free trade, collective security, and global institutions not as sources of American primacy, but as a raw deal, a way for the world to free ride on American power. President Donald Trump is not the cause of that sentiment. It hardened in the late 2000s as a financial crisis at home met the spectacle of a rising China, one climbing through the very trade rules Washington had built to its own advantage. the suspicion that America had written an order others were winning under took root across both parties. Never left. Trump tapped it, rode it, inflamed it, recognizing Americans' changing views of the national interest and America's role in the world. The U.S. has always been unpredictable, lurching between administrations, isolationist one decade, interventionist the next. Going quietly on the world's crises, then acting on them with little warning. As Winston Churchill never quite said, you can count on the Americans to do the right thing, but only after they've exhausted the alternatives. Erratic, but ultimately dependable. Not anymore. Under Trump, the world's superpower has become something it's rarely been before, an unreliable actor on the global stage. The U.S. today does not just keep allies guessing about its next move. It makes them doubt whether it will honor its last commitment. Countries sign deals and watch Washington rewrite the terms. Intelligence sharing is suspended overnight. Foreign aid is cut off. America's unreliability has become the driver of geopolitical instability, the thing every foreign ministry now has to plan around. Washington is dismantling its own order, just as America's role has grown more important to the rest of the world. Europe, Britain, Canada, Japan, other U.S. allies spent decades underinvesting in their own security and now depend on Washington for both their security and their prosperity, just as Americans want their government to do less, not more, on the international stage. Jolted awake by Trump's second term, they've belatedly begun to hedge. Europe is rearming and has closed trade agreements with India and the South American bloc, Mercosur. Canada's diversifying its trade. Gulf states are building ties that do not run through D.C. Not all of it will last. Some of the sharpest disruptions, the score settling, the deals undone by a social media post, the threats against allies' sovereignty, the regime change operations are particular to this president. The places where his personal interest diverges from the national interest, and he pursues the former at the latter's expense. They do serious damage, but they'll recede after he leaves office. Trust can be rebuilt if from a lower baseline, but there is no going back. The rupture of the old order, as Prime Minister Mark Carney of Canada described it at Davos, will outlast Trump. Protectionism, unilateralism, skepticism of democracy, promotion, and foreign aid now command support across both parties and among a generation of voters. The next president, Republican or Democrat, will inherit an electorate that wants less engagement with the world. For the U.S., it isn't so much a rupture as a return. Trump will pass, the inward turn will not. At 250, this is just who America is now. This next article may be abridged for time constraints. This is titled The Environment, A Rising Tide, A Sinking Town. A waterlogged North Carolina community meets climate change. There are some photographs here. They were by Cornell Watson. And the text is by Simone Shaw, S-H-A-H. Lovey Miller does not remember a time when floods were not a part of life in Scranton, North Carolina. A native North Carolinian, Miller left the area after high school, but when she moved back home in 2009, she quickly realized the floods were nothing like the interludes she remembered experiencing as a child, legs dangling over the water as it lapped at the porch, a close enough approximation to a swimming pool. So every year when the news brought warnings of a summer storm, she would pack her bags and evacuate to higher ground. But when Hurricane Irene hit in August 2011, she decided to stay. "I just wanted to see what happens," Miller says. "You could not see the fence. The water was over the knob of the garage door. It was like I'm sitting in the middle of an ocean." That may be apt. Rising sea levels have put this rural, historically black community on the front lines of the climate crisis. Scranton lies in a low-lying county defined by waterways on a coast where seas are expected to rise by 10 to 12 inches by 2050. The waters on the U.S. southeast and Gulf coasts are among the fastest rising in the U.S., reaching record-breaking rates of half an inch per year since 2010. On North Carolina's northeastern coast, where Scranton is located, sea levels have risen about 2 inches per decade since 1978, and the impacts are already being felt. Scranton often experiences sunny day flooding when high tides cause water to spill over onto land, closing down roads and flooding homes with increasing frequency. When hurricane season arrives, the town sometimes sees flooding, even when it is not in the path of the storm. Cornell Watson has been visiting Scranton since 2022 to document how flooding is being felt there. "We do not suddenly go from dry land to underwater overnight," says Miyuki Hino, associate professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who has studied the impact of sea level rise in North Carolina. "The way this happens is little by little. Over time, the water level rises, and in this slow, pernicious, hard-to-see way, it creeps up on you, and all of a sudden you're flooding 10 days a year, then 30 days a year, then 50 days a year." National adaptation measures tend to focus on large economic hubs like New York City and Miami. A lot of the major flood risk reduction projects have largely been federally funded and been in metropolitan coastal areas, says Hino. "For a lot of the rest of the country that does not have that level of concentrated urban development, it is a really different picture." In towns like Scranton, scant federal funds mean many people have to take on the costs themselves. Leland Howard, who saw 3 feet of water enter his home during Hurricane Floyd in 2018, has not been able to raise his home off the ground and has made home repairs himself. The vulnerabilities compound. Studies have found that those living in poverty are more likely to live in flood-prone areas, and rural areas facing population decline often have fewer resources to devote toward climate-resilient infrastructure and disaster preparedness. Scranton's population is aging and dwindling, with many younger residents leaving to make a life elsewhere. "They go to other places because there's no work here," says Anne Mann, who has little immediate family left in Scranton. Many residents, though, won't let the floods drive them away. If anything, it's something they are resigned to. "When water starts coming in, it gives me a headache," says Gretchen Davis, who lost her home because of flooding in Hurricane Florence in 2018. "I've been in Scranton all my life. I was born in it. Guess I'll die in it." There are some photos here, quite a few. I'll read the captions of a couple. There's a church here, a white church with a steeple and a cross on top, stairways, maybe 10 or 12 steps going up to the front door, and there's also a ramp for people with limited abilities for climbing steps, and there's a big pond in the front yard. The big pond surrounds the very stylish sign that says St. John Missionary Baptist Church. Pastor Elder John Bailey, I think. A lot of trees behind the church, and here's the caption. Floodwaters from a king tide surround St. John's Missionary Baptist Church during a homecoming service to celebrate their 150th anniversary, October 12, 2025. Churches in Scranton used to be a gathering place for residents during flooding events, but no longer. The church is not safe anymore, says Ann Mann. We've had churches in our area flood out and never go back to be a church again. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.